ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show for you this week. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. So guess what's back in the financial news and getting a lot more run recently? Bitcoin. Of course, back in December of 2017, Bitcoin had shot up to nearly 20,000. There was all sorts of fanfare. And then it proceeded to fall some 80%+ to about 3,200 this past December. The bubble popped, and so things quieted down rather significantly. But now Bitcoin is surging again. It's one of the top-performing assets in 2019. At last check, it's, doubled, which means Bitcoin is back to getting some attention. And Connor, of course, we can't help ourselves on this topic. We have to wade back into the discussion and talk Bitcoin and Bitcoin ETFs. And actually, a couple of weeks ago, there was a new filing for a Bitcoin and Ethereum ETF from USCF. So we do have a legitimate reason to discuss this. In just a moment, ETF.com, Sumeet Roy will join us to chime in on the topic. We'll talk Bitcoin, Bitcoin ETFs, even a little gold and its relationship with Bitcoin. But look, I'll just say I know some people hate Bitcoin. They're tired of hearing about it. And then, of course, you have other people who love Bitcoin, right? They think it's the future of everything. There's no question Bitcoin is very polarizing, actually, just like gold. But the thing is, I don't think it's going away. That doesn't mean good investment, but I do think it's helpful to know what's going on here. Just be educated as an investor.
Yeah, I guess in a mea culpa, we're as guilty as anyone for jumping back onto the media bandwagon here with Bitcoin. Any investment that, you know, is well known and has huge swings in prices is volatile. I mean, whether it's oil or, boy, a company like Tesla, right, or these recent IPOs, with Uber and Lyft, I mean, getting a lot of attention. That's all well and true, but it seems like the media coverage seems magnified and amplified when it's Bitcoin, when it's cryptos that we're talking about. I read an article from Bloomberg last week that referenced a study by a Yale economist that found that increased chatter about Bitcoin on Twitter resulted in higher returns the following week in Bitcoin price. Now, you know, who knows what's driving what here, right? It's the old chicken or the egg debate. But there's no doubt that with Bitcoin prices surging over the past several weeks, and honestly, almost since kind of the start of the year, the media coverage is ramped up as well, right alongside Bitcoin price.
Yeah, so in any event, we'll start with Sumeet Roy. Should be a good conversation. And then also on the show this week is Phil Bock, CEO of Exponential ETFs. They offer an ETF that flips the S&P 500 on its head. It's the reverse cap weighted U.S. large cap ETF. And I'm going to try something a little bit different with Phil. I'm going to offer some objections to this ETF. I'll sort of flip the script given this ETF, and I'm going to see if Phil can fend off my attacks. We'll also hit Phil with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A, so that should be a lot of fun. And then we'll close this week with Todd Sunderland, partner and head of quant strategies at Cushing. They offer a suite of what are called the Cushing Sector Plus ETFs. These focus on the energy sector and MLP space, so we'll do a deep dive on those in our ETF spotlight. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Also, if you enjoy ETF Prime, we would greatly appreciate if you could leave us a quick review on iTunes. Let's start by talking Bitcoin and Bitcoin ETFs with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Sumeet, let's start with this recent filing from USCF for the Crescent Crypto Index Fund. This would hold both Bitcoin and Ethereum. Now, there are a couple of other Bitcoin ETFs still awaiting word from the SEC, right? The VanEck Solidex Bitcoin Trust and the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF. Though I don't think there's any expectation these are going to be approved anytime soon. Were you surprised to see another crypto ETF filing? It just seems like maybe fund companies would want to wait and see if there's any movement from the SEC on these other filings first.
Thanks for having me, Nate. And yeah, you're exactly right. I was a little bit surprised when I heard about these filings. Like you said, they're going to be holding both Bitcoin and Ethereum if they were to come to market. And they're going to be holding those on a market cap weighted basis. Now, the issuer behind these funds actually has a little history of pioneering new types of ETFs. We're talking about United States Commodity Funds, USCF. And they brought the first oil and the first natural gas ETFs to market. So maybe they think their fate is going to be different because they have that history, they have that leg up on other issuers, and they've brought, you know, esoteric products into the ETF wrapper. So it remains to be seen whether, you know, they're going to get approval. Probably not, is my guess. But, you know, why not try, right?
Well, yeah, and I guess... Yeah, I mean, on that note, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask you anyway. I mean, have you heard anything new as it relates to the SEC's review of the VanEck or Bitwise ETFs? Because obviously that would be key in USCF having any shot at success here.
Yeah, there really hasn't been anything new, but we have been seeing some constructive comments from some of the SEC commissioners. Robert Jackson, he's an SEC commissioner. There's a leaked interview, and he said that it's only a matter of time before there's an ETF out there that satisfies the SEC's requirements to gain approval. So, you know, that's good stuff coming out of the SEC, constructive talk. But, you know, incidentally, we are actually we're supposed to get the decision on the VanEck fund and the Bitwise fund this week and next week. I think the decision dates were May 16th and May 21st. But the SEC has delayed these decisions many, many times. So I don't think anyone's holding their breath that, you know, this week they're going to approve or say something different than they've said already. But, yeah, the issues are the same. The SEC is still concerned about, you know, how do you value cryptocurrencies, you know, given that they trade on so many different exchanges, so many different fractured exchanges all around the world. There's concerns about liquidity. There's concerns about extreme volatility. And the biggest concern is probably about price manipulation. Every day we're hearing, you know, Bitcoin could be being manipulated. And, you know, that's really at the heart of the SEC's concerns. And also at the heart of the SEC's concern is protecting retail investors. They keep talking about it. So any solution to their concerns is going to have to be seen through that lens. How do you protect retail investors? And, you know, some of these ETFs, they've tried to create mechanisms to prevent retail investors from getting burned. You know, things like putting a high share price, really high share price, in the case of the VanEck ETF, $200,000 on the ETF. They've taken out insurance on the portfolio of the ETF. They put multiple cryptocurrencies in a basket to offer diversification. So far, none of these measures have really satisfied the SEC, but, you know, at some point, maybe it will.
Sumit, I agree that the SEC, they're obviously trying to protect retail investors, but one of the issues I have, there's something called the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, ticker GBTC, which trades over the counter. And this isn't some small fund. This thing has like $1.2 billion in assets. But here's the kicker. It trades at like a 30% premium. It has a unique structure where new shares are only offered on a periodic basis. For me, it just seems hard to reconcile that we have this thing trading and available to everyday retail investors, but no Bitcoin ETF. Do you agree that seems somewhat incongruent?
Absolutely, Nate. It is somewhat incongruent. And it is ironic that, you know, the SEC continues to reject these products, which would be much more, would be much superior to the GBTC. On the other hand, they allowed GBTC to trade, but these other products, products are getting rejected. And like you said, you know, this is a flawed product. It's trading, I think, currently 30-40% premium to net asset value. And if you go all the way back to 2017, when Bitcoin was at 20,000 and it was at its peak, this was trading at over 100% premium to its net asset value. As you know, and your audience knows, it's never a good idea to buy something for such a large premium, but people are still buying it because there's really no other avenue to get exposure to Bitcoin through your traditional brokerage account. So in that respect, GBTC is the only game in town. And just to give some background on, you know, what GBTC is, from a structural perspective, it's basically an open-ended trust. They do periodic private placements, like you said, but that's only to accredited investors. And you have to have something like over $1 million in assets, over $200,000 of income. So everyone else that wants to buy this, they have to go over the counter to buy it. And OTC securities aren't regulated by the SEC the same way that exchange-traded securities are. So that's why you see like a product like this continue to thrive, even though the SEC is rejecting much superior products from coming to market.
Yeah, and unfortunately, some investors do confuse this with an ETF. Something else I'll mention, too, just recently in the news was the hack of Binance, one of the largest crypto exchanges. Over $40 million in Bitcoin was stolen. And look, they essentially self-insured, and so it doesn't look like investors will lose anything. But a Bitcoin ETF would solve this problem, right? Because if you look at the VanEck SolidX ETF filing, you know, they're going to use state-of-the-art cold storage solutions, and it's insured against the risk of loss or theft. So I do think an ETF solves some problem and some problems, and it doesn't make sense to me that something like GBTC
Absolutely.
Continues to trade. But one other question here on Bitcoin ETFs. There's been talk of Fidelity beginning to custody and allow for crypto trading in the near future, I believe for institutional clients. But if we were to get to the point where major brokerages allow this for retail clients as well, do you think that sort of negates the need for Bitcoin ETFs or other crypto ETFs?
Super good question, Nate. And yeah, Fidelity is coming out. Institutional clients are going to be able to trade crypto on their platform. And I think E-Trade is going to allow even retail customers to trade crypto on their platform. And Ameritrade also testing that. It's just a matter of time before crypto trading is widespread among the big traditional brokerage firms. At least it looks like that. And that is pretty big. And in some ways, it negates the need for crypto ETFs, because one of the biggest selling points of a Bitcoin ETF was, you know, with the ETF, you didn't have to deal with digital asset exchanges, digital wallets, things like that. You could just buy Bitcoin in your regular brokerage account. That was the big selling point. So if you could do that without an ETF, is there a need for an ETF? So it reduces the appeal from that aspect. But an ETF could still be useful if you think about it, because what if they offer a basket of cryptocurrencies in the ETF? Then that's instant diversification, just like an ETF offers instant diversification for stocks. And even a single crypto ETF could be useful if the crypto trading services that the brokerages are thinking of offering is separate from the regular stock trading platform. Because I know on Ameritrade you can trade futures and things like that, but that's on a separate platform than the one you used to buy stocks and ETFs. So in that respect, an ETF could still be superior.
Sumit, we have just a few minutes left. Moving away from Bitcoin ETFs, something that I think is an issue, something I continue to think a lot about, is just this interplay between Bitcoin and gold, because Bitcoin has been called digital gold or gold 2.0. And when I talk to younger investors and ask them if they prefer Bitcoin or gold, Bitcoin wins in a landslide. It's not even close. Do you see that as a problem for gold moving forward?
It could be a problem for gold. I mean, there's this huge debate, coming up, Bitcoin versus gold. Is Bitcoin gold 2.0? Is Bitcoin gold for millennials, digital gold, things like that? And, I think it's a problem for gold that people are even asking these questions, because for a long time, gold was the epitome of a safe haven. And it has been that way for hundreds of years, thousands of years. So if you're a gold proponent, you're probably going to point to that fact, that gold has been around for hundreds of years as a safe haven. It's held its value compared to Bitcoin, which has only been around for a little over a decade. So that's the big difference between the two. But, if enough people believe that Bitcoin is a safe haven or a store of value, then maybe that's all it takes to become one. I mean, just this week we saw the stock market pull back by 5%, but Bitcoin was rallying pretty hard. Is Bitcoin on its way to replacing gold? I think, the only true answer is time is going to tell whether that's the case. We need more data and we need more history on Bitcoin.
Yeah, and one of the things I actually thought was problematic for Bitcoin was how much it dropped during the fourth quarter of last year when the stock market was declining, right? It was down like 40%.
Right, right.
It didn't act like a safe haven or store value at all. And at the same time, gold actually went up. Do you think Bitcoin will need to prove itself in a down market like that? Or does that not matter?
I think, it still has to prove itself in that regard if it wants to become gold 2.0. A lot of people aren't going to believe that Bitcoin is truly a safe haven unless it starts to act like one. And, the stuff we saw this week with Bitcoin going up with the stock market down, that's a step in that direction. But you don't need everyone to convert from gold to Bitcoin. Even if just a fraction of the people holding gold as an investment convert to Bitcoin, that's going to do a lot for Bitcoin demand. We have billions upon billions of dollars in gold ETFs and even more money tied up in it, gold physical bars for investment. So if just a fraction of that switch from gold to Bitcoin, I think that's a huge boon for Bitcoin.
Well, Sumit, really appreciate you joining us this week. Great insight as always. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com, Sumit Roy. Let's take a break, and when we come back, Exponential ETF's Phil Bock and I will discuss the reverse cap-weighted ETF, and I'll also hit Phil with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. And now joining us via phone from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Phil Bock, CEO of Exponential ETFs. They're behind the reverse cap weighted U.S. large cap ETF, which has one of the better ticker symbols out there, reverse, RVRS. Phil, always great having you on the show.
Great to be back on. Thank you.
So, Phil, I tried to get creative here, which admittedly isn't always my strong suit. But I'm trying to keep things fresh on ETF Prime. So given that you offer this reverse cap weighted ETF, I thought it might be fun to try and reverse my usual interview format. Instead of having you spotlight this ETF, I want to play devil's advocate and bring up some common objections, things I've heard, things I know you've heard on why not to use this ETF. And I thought you'd be the perfect person for this because I know you're confident in this product. You're not worried about addressing these questions. First, just so everyone's on the same page, though, I'll let you provide some basics here. So if you would, just give us a quick overview as to what reverse does, and then I'll start peppering you with my questions.
All right, let's do it. Reverse is very simple. It's the S&P 500 constituents, but rather than being weighted largest to smallest by the market cap, we weight the 500 stocks by the reciprocal of the market cap, one over the market cap. And what we get is a portfolio that is a U.S. large cap fund. You know, the weighted average market cap is just under $20 billion. But we're tilted towards the companies that, you know, we think, by definition, the smaller companies have a better risk-return profile. And it also allows us to build in a mean reversion mechanism where we buy low and sell high as a course of business, as a course of rebounds, as part of the process of managing the fund.
All right, Phil. So some would say just go buy a plain vanilla mid-cap ETF. That if you look at the performance and risk profile of reverse, it's very similar to that of a mid-cap stock ETF, which theoretically you could get cheaper. So what would be your response to that?
Yeah, and that's a, you know, that's a fair objection. I would say what you'd want to do is get a reverse cap weighted mid-cap fund. And, you know, what mid-cap does is mid-cap captures a size premium relative to large cap, just like reverse does. Now, the weighted average market cap in most mid-cap funds is significantly lower than reverse. And, you know, you get stocks that are market cap weighted, so you're tilted towards the higher end of wherever they cut off the mid-cap range. And you get that size premium a little more so than you do with reverse. But now you've got a basket of stocks that have less analyst coverage, less quality, and they're still market cap weighted, which means that every quarterly rebound, you're still taking money out of the losers and putting it into the winners. You're constantly buying high. So what you lose, if you took a basket of stocks that matched the weighted average market cap of reverse, and it was diversified enough so you can capture that exact size premium that we're exploiting, what you would lose is that mean reversion mechanism. So what that means is before the global financial crisis, when the financial sector was dominating the S&P, reverse was unwinding that position, was profit-taking at every rebound and whacking it back, and was underweight before the global financial crisis, severely underweight financials. You look at it today and you say, wow, this fund looks like it's an anti-FANG fund or it's an anti-technology fund, and it is. And if we see an unwinding of that technology trade in the coming years, we're going to be very good beneficiaries of that. You lose that by being in a market cap weighted mid cap fund.
Okay, so let me flip that around. When people talk about the shortcomings of market cap weighting, as you mentioned, you often hear about the tech bubble and financial crisis, right? The S&P 500 was overloaded on tech stocks in 2000 and financials in 2008. Investors were exposed to outsized risk because of that. On the other hand, there is a stat out there that like 4% of stocks have contributed to all of the returns in the U.S. stock market since 1926. So the point being that it's usually the biggest winners that lead to the bulk of the returns in the market. So wouldn't reverse cap weighting prevent that from happening?
No, you want to get them while they're cheap. You want to buy them when they come into the S&P at a lower valuation. That's where you want to buy them, not when they've run up and they're high. If you think about it, if you look at where Netflix came into the S&P, it came in as the 300th company at the time that it entered the S&P. So we would have been slightly overweight in reverse cap weight. Now you look at the valuation today, you say, you know, this company, you know, phenomenal growth story. Everyone loves Netflix, and we love it in our ACSI fund because it's got great customer satisfaction, a lot of customer loyalty. But is it overvalued? A lot of people think it is. So if you're in a market cap weighted fund and that is your view, you're going to be overweight in a market cap weighted versus underweight today. And you look at the contribution of those FANG names to the S&P 500 performance, they have in fact dominated. You're 100% right. But that was last cycle. And unless you have a time machine to go along with your market cap weighted fund, I don't know how that looks going forward.
Okay, what about an equal weight ETF? Oftentimes when I see a write-up or piece on reverse, you'll see equal weight, you know, included in that as well. Why not use equal weight instead?
I love equal weight, and I think equal weight is significantly better than market cap weighted over the long term. equal weight is a half measure. If you think about a seesaw or you think about a scale, right, you've got two ends, you've got market cap weight. And once you've accepted that equal weight because of the rebalance mechanism, that equal weight is going to, over the long term, like it has done over the last 30 years, is going to outperform the market cap weighted, why would you stop at that half measure? You've already decided that these bottom end stocks in the S&P 500 that's tilting away from the top end towards the middle, towards the bottom, that there is alpha to be had there. We'll just turn the dial a little further to get the stocks that you actually want. They're actually driving that alpha over the long term. And instead of at every quarterly rebalance, whacking all the stocks that went up back to flat and taking that profit, which is how equal weight derives most of its alpha, more so than the size tilt, well, why not go a step further? And why not be over-allocated in those companies that have the most room to run, that have the most room to catch up in the S&P, and the most long-term growth in front of them?
Phil, not directly related to the investment approach of reverse, but two areas I know you have to continually overcome objections on are the assets and trading volume in reverse. So some investors will say, hey, there's not enough assets in the ETF. I need to see 100 million or whatever. And then others might say, well, this ETF only trades, you know, 6,500 shares a day. It's not liquid. How do you address both of those?
Look, I mean, they're all fair questions. I love the first set of questions that we have. I love geeking out and talking about the strategy and why we think it makes sense. You know, we start getting into a lot of conversations about what are our economics, what is our size, what's our funding, what's the liquidity of the fund. And a lot of people are just, you know, there seems to be this shift that happens where in every sector that you deal with, when you look at these up-and-coming startup companies that bring great ideas to market, everyone is very excited to work with them. But somehow the narrative has been stolen in the financial services industry where people just want to work with the largest funds and the largest issuers who are not doing exciting things by and large. And, you know, we like to attack that head on. We think that there is edge to be had by discovering a great new fund that your competitors aren't necessarily using. And if you're able to source liquidity better than your competitors by either working through your, you know, the capital markets desk at the issuer that you're working with. We have a capital markets desk here. By working with the trading desk at the broker dealer, the custody firm that you clear through, you can access that liquidity. And, you know, maybe your competitors are scared off by a fund because of the asset size. That gives you edge. So that's my main point on it. But the other thing is that, you know, the measures of liquidity in a fund, and people talk about, well, the underlying components are very liquid and therefore enough liquidity can be made in the fund. And that's 100% true if you're trading in size, but you still need to work through a market participant, typically an AP, in order to get that liquidity through the creation redemption mechanism. The secondary market liquidity, the bids and spreads, what you get if you're just trading, let's say you're just putting in market orders, which you should never do, but let's say you're putting in market orders on the exchange. Well, that should be measured by spreads and depth. And we're very proud. We've put a lot of work into managing the secondary market and the quality of markets of our funds. And when people just say, oh, the AUM is low, therefore it's not liquid, you know, it really takes all the work that we've done in managing the liquidity of the fund, and it really discounts it. So, you know, that is something that we've certainly taken issue with, and we really hope there's more awareness in the market about how to truly measure liquidity.
All right, before we move on, any other common objections to reverse that you hear? I think we hit on all the main ones that I had.
I think people say it's too wonderful, Nate. It's just too good, and they can't wait to get in.
Our guest is Phil Bock, CEO of Exponential ETFs. All right, Phil, with the remaining time we have, I want to hit you with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. I have some questions that I think you'll like on a much more friendly note, and I want to start with ETF intellectual property. So I know you have some concerns regarding the fact that larger ETF providers can simply rip off the best ideas from smaller providers. I share those concerns. Do you have a solution here? I mean, is there anything that can be done?
In the product design, there are certain things that could be done to protect intellectual property. So, you know, we're out. We came up with the concept of reverse. We've done a tremendous amount of research and, you know, write about it and try to popularize the idea. Anybody can reverse weight any index, and, you know, there's nothing proprietary about just saying, hey, we're taking the reciprocal of the market cap. But we do have an exclusive license with S&P, so we have some protection there, and we think that that is the best index, not only because, you know, S&P is, you know, so well-regarded and well-used, but also because there's $9 trillion benchmark to that index, which, you know, may or may not provide some artificial support to some of the bottom names that we benefit from. But, you know, in the product design, our customer satisfaction fund, we use a proprietary database that is far superior to anything else out there in that space. They have a patented econometric model, several white papers, it's based on the work of Professor Klaus Fornell, who's one of the most cited academics in the entire country. So, you know, there are things that you can do in the product design to help protect yourself, and the onus should be on the product developer to put in those protections. We don't hide from that. You know, we think that's the case, and if we do something that's easy replicable, that's a flaw in our design patterns. But what I think, you know, there should be some shame in somebody who either takes a concept from one issuer and asks another issuer to do it, which we've seen happen, or in a fund company that has, you know, armies of researchers and product developers and, you know, all the resources in the world, that they're not able to come up with their own ideas, that they have to go and borrow what other people have come up with. There should be some shame in that.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the thing that I struggle with just as an entrepreneur myself. You know, I know the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into starting up a business. You come up with a great idea, and it's got to be disheartening to see somebody, you know, who's larger and more established, just be able to pick off those best ideas. And certainly to what you were saying earlier in the investment space, you know, look, you can't really, you know, everybody wants to copy Warren Buffett, right? You can't really, trademark that per se or put a patent on it. So I get it. I don't know that there's an easy solution here, but it is something frustrating. On a lighter note, I know you made the comparison between the ETF industry and the beer industry. So the question that I have is, if Exponential ETFs was a craft beer, what would it be?
Bell's. Bell's here in Michigan, or I might even go Founders, you know, with the all-day IPA. But, you know, we are Detroit-based. I know you introduced me in Ann Arbor. We just recently moved to Detroit, and Michigan has some of the best brewers in the entire country here. So I'd have to go with the hometown, Bell's or Founders.
Okay, and on that note, I've seen you tweet quite a bit about Detroit wineries. So do you prefer wine or beer?
Well, I prefer beer, unfortunately. That might get me in a little bit of trouble. I drink beer, I drink whiskey, and I drink a little bit of mezcal. But Detroit Vineyard is a wonderful winery that we've opened up in partnership with Professor Fornell and Blake Nacki over there. And, you know, they're a sister company of ours. We have the same backing and funding. And if anyone's in Detroit, give me a call. We'll give you a tour. It's a wonderful place.
All right, so I'll ask you the same question. If Exponential ETFs was a wine, what would it be?
Oh, no. I'm just not that knowledgeable in wines, but I'll go with Detroit Vineyards because that's a cop-out, but it's easy.
All right, I don't want to get you in trouble here. Should I ask you what beer, wine, iShares, or Vanguard would be, or will that get you in too much trouble?
That might get me in too much trouble, but I will say that, you know, Budweiser and Coors have very good distribution, are very cheap, and are very bland.
All right, fair enough. Phil, since you're not a fan of market cap weighting, if you look at the FANG stocks right now, are there any you just absolutely despise, or is it all of them? And if so, why?
You know, I think Amazon may or may not be overvalued here, but it's an incredible company. Apple, we think there are some challenges for them penetrating the emerging markets, but, you know, they have a very strong customer base here in the U.S., and they've built, you know, really strong ecosystem. You look at Facebook, and you just wonder how it has the valuation it has. I mean, this is a company that people specifically do not like. They do not like going on there. Some people go on there anyways, have it, but they're declining. They make all their money. Over 96% of their revenue comes from ads. Nobody looks at these ads. People avoid these ads. Our eyes are trained as we scroll through the web to ignore these advertisements. They've got massive antitrust regulation risk. They've got massive regulatory risks on different fronts. They're not able to penetrate the emerging markets that they're supposed to. And it's just amazing to me that the valuation on Facebook right now is higher than the GDP of Sweden. I mean, just to sell some ads online, I just don't see it. I don't understand it. And, I personally, I don't make a lot of single stock calls, but in this case, I'm extremely bearish on Facebook.
All right. On the note of single stocks, out of all the holdings in reverse, do you have a favorite stock? And to be very clear, this is not an investment recommendation. Just a company you really appreciate what they're doing right now.
Yeah, well, so, you know, reverse is very process is driven, you know, process driven. It's a strategy that speaks to some quants, at least those who aren't, you know, too drawn into the allure of opaqueness, those that can accept the simplicity of it. It's a quantitative strategy, and you know, we don't care what stocks are in it. It's the reciprocal, the market cap that's in the S&P 500, that's it. But ACSI, our other fund, is much more of a stock picker's type of fund where we say, you know, based on not my intuition or not what, you know, the firmness of the CEO's handshake, based on a large sample set of normalized data of their customers, not people that have opinions, but people that have actually transacted with that company, what are those people saying? Are they going to be back? Is there recurring revenue? Is there, you know, and when you look at it, you know, we picked up on Shake Shack super early. We picked up on Facebook, speaking of Facebook, super early, had very high customer satisfaction, and then it turned negative about 2 years ago, and, you know, came out of our portfolio as such, and you know, a lot of their problems have arisen since then. So, you know, that's the area where I really tend to find picker, favorites and not.
All right, Phil, last question. What excites you most about the future of the ETF industry?
I think right now we're seeing in some levels, and you know, we've talked about this just now, but in some levels there are some, you know, gates that are being put up around the innovators and this, you know, startup type companies, and it's a little bit dangerous. But in other areas, you see it continuing to bubble up in different ways. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, the big guys try to keep the little guys down, and the little guys keep finding other ways to pop up. And, you know, when you go online, you know, you go on Twitter. I love Twitter. Twitter to me is like being in New York. You go to New York, there's garbage everywhere. It smells like piss. You don't know if you're going to get pushed onto the subway tracks, but it's New York. You're running around. You're doing meetings. There's business opportunities. There's places to eat. It's just a fun energy. To me, that's what Twitter is. And you go on Twitter and start scrolling through, and yeah, you know, it does smell like piss, and there are some very rude people, and you know, I can get drawn into it too. I'm not immune. But you also see, you know, an exchange of ideas that you've never seen anywhere else. You see, you know, people that are doing things, people that are seeking best practices, best knowledge, and it really does, you know, generate a lot of excitement for the future of the industry.
Phil, very well said. Love the analogy. Fun chat as always. Love having you on the show. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks, Nick.
That was Phil Bock, CEO of Exponential ETFs. And you can learn more about Reverse along with their other ETFs by visiting exponentialetfs.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll spotlight a suite of ETFs focused on the energy sector and MLPs. They come from Cushing Asset Management. We'll be joined by the head of quant strategies at Cushing, Todd Sunderland. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Let's go right to our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
We're actually spotlighting a suite of ETFs this week. They come from Cushing Asset Management. These are four ETFs focused on the energy sector and MLPs. And joining us via phone from Dallas to discuss these ETFs is Todd Sunderland, partner and head of quant strategies at Cushing. Todd, thanks for joining us this week.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Todd, first, tell us a little bit about Cushing. So as I understand it, in addition to the ETFs we'll spotlight today, Cushing powers the indexes behind two MLP ETNs, one from Morgan Stanley and the other from JP Morgan. What's the history of Cushing in the energy space, and how did you get involved in ETNs and ETFs?
Thank you. Yes, Cushing was founded in 2003, focusing on the MLP space, and I think we'll get into that a little bit later here. But and since then, we've expanded to broader energy industrials. We manage about $3 billion in private funds, open and closed-end mutual funds, some SMAs, and most recently, we launched the four ETFs that you highlighted at the beginning. Our first index was launched in 2009, And that's one of the notes from J.P. Morgan are based off of that one. And our general approach is to reasonably emphasize current income while de-emphasizing market cap. And we're trying to broaden the scope of the definition a little bit and hopefully bring something unique to market.
Yeah, and before we talk about the ETFs, anytime we talk MLPs on the show, I always like to ask for a quick definition, just for investors unfamiliar with this space. So can you briefly explain what an MLP is?
Certainly. And we'll start off with the acronym. The MLP is Master Limited Partnership, and we're talking about publicly traded energy MLPs for today. MLPs don't pay a corporate-level tax, but the tax is paid by the partners, and that is relayed through the Schedule K-1 tax form. The point of that is the corporation doesn't pay a tax. There's not a double level of tax payment. Generally, it's a midstream company that we're talking about, and midstream is a broader term for company activities that encompass the MLPs and corporations providing that service from wellhead to consumer of oil and natural gas.
All right, so back in December, Cushing launched a suite of four ETFs. These are called the Cushing Sector Plus ETFs, and let me run through these. We have the Cushing Energy and MLP ETF, ticker XLEY, the Cushing Utility and MLP ETF, XLUY, the Cushing Transportation and MLP ETF, XLTY, and then the Cushing Energy Supply Chain and MLP ETF, XLSY. I guess first, explain the purpose of the suite as a whole, and then perhaps we can drill down into one or two of these ETFs in more detail.
Yeah, thank you. Sounds good. The primary emphasis is that MLPs have historically been excluded from indices that are broad market or popularized with the sector indices from the S&P 500 or Dow Jones Transportation or Dow Jones in general. And we wanted to combine MLPs and midstream companies with sectors that fundamentally made sense, industries and business lines where they related. So think of energy at the wellhead, the MLPs connect that wellhead to the refinery or the chemical company. Transportation, they do a lot of similar activities as transportation companies, and sometimes there's trucking and rail within the MLP structures. Utilities is similar to the wellhead in connecting the pipelines to the utility companies, primarily natural gas. And then the energy supply chain is that entire tip-to-tail type of framework. And what we did to make this a very palatable indice suite is we licensed from S&P Dow Jones the sector indices and the transportation average, and then we combined that with the MLPs. We tweaked the constituents a bit by weighting them on yield, capping it at 6% and adding 24% of MLPs. And the goal of that effort was to have a sector or industry index at the end that had a little bit of an income tilt relative to existing offerings.
Yeah, so if we look a little bit deeper into one of these ETFs, let's maybe take the Cushing Energy and MLP ETF, XLEY. Walk us through exactly what this does in a bit more detail.
Certainly. The XLEY are the constituents from the S&P Energy Index, and those are weighted on yield, and that represents 76% of the index, but that's capped at 6%. And then the MLPs provide 24% of the index. And this one gets a little wonkier, but it's 12 constituents at 2% each from the Cushing 30. We yield rank those constituents and then use constituents 6 through 17. The idea there was to have the income benefit but not get to names that are in a potentially in duress or corporate stress by having the highest yielding instruments. And so in the end, you have the S&P Energy, the Cushing 30, and those risk profiles of the S&P Energy Index and the Cushing Energy Index are very similar, and that's what the XLEY seeks to track. And about 50% of the yield increase comes from the energy companies reweighted on yield and the MLPs, or the other 50%.
So just at a high level, I mean, is the idea here to try to pursue additional yield. So with this ETF, like you said, it includes exposure to components of the S&P 500 Energy Index, and you are doing some weighting based on yield, but obviously with the MLP component, that's adding a component of yield. Is that the ultimate goal here, I guess, along with some diversification?
Yes, there's the yield, the diversification, and broadening the space that is in the index. Like, so for instance, energy and MLPs, where the access to that would be limited by two different products. We're combining that in one ETF or one avenue for investors to check out. And then when we add those, because the business lines are so similar, the risk profile by correlation and beta to the S&P are almost identical. So what we're trying to do is add a component and add an attribute to the sector exposure without meaningfully changing that risk profile.
Out of curiosity, why not combine the strategies from the four ETFs into a single ETF? Why break them out separately?
And there are several questions along that line, and also just what you do with all the sectors, you know, so kind of end of spectrums of suggestions and ideas. And the framework we're trying to do is, as investors look at the energy landscape or transportation landscape or utility landscape or the entire energy supply chain, is to provide something that is easily digestible, something they're already familiar with, and we add a little bit of yield and reduce the concentration. One thing we didn't touch on quite yet is that when you market cap weight some of these sectors, you end up with an index or an ETF that has a lot of concentration in just a few names. For instance, in the energy ETF they were talking about 40% of the exposure comes from two names. And then when we add the MLPs, obviously they get some diversification, like you said, but we also remain a RIC, a regulated investment company, and also we're Form 1099 dividend payer. So that might be some benefits as well. But the framework of not having them all in one was to allow investors to pick and choose the exposures they want. A utility might be a little more defensive. Energy might be a little more aggressive. Transportation might be more of a representation of that early GDP play. And the energy supply chain might be for folks that, you know, I hear the energy, I want some of that exposure, but I don't want all just in upstream or midstream or downstream. Let me get a little bit of exposure across the spectrum.
Our guest is Todd Sunderland, partner and head of quant strategies at Cushing. We're spotlighting their Cushing Sector Plus ETFs. Todd, I always have to ask about fees. These ETFs charge 65 basis points, 0.65%. What was the thought process here?
Certainly. And the fee is unitary. And what does that mean? There's nothing else in there. There's no, as credit cards might say, there's no hidden fees or fund drags to surprise you. And as a smaller ETF operator, it's a little difficult to get the scale of some of the larger players, but that's our problem. That's our challenge. For the investor, we think there's a benefit in defining the analysis along the income less your fee construct. So if you're comparing different sector funds or different funds in their orientation, let's look at the income stream or the yield less the fee and compare it on that nature, so you're not just on a one or single factor or single attribute. Now, this is not to say you shouldn't go for a cheaper, broad market indices, but we think we're bringing a little bit of a different value set, a differentiated exposure for investors by broadening the spectrum for these sectors while also increasing that income stream.
Todd, we only have about 2 minutes left. As you look at the energy space, is there anything in particular you're watching for moving forward?
Sure. I mean, energy is it's very interesting times in the space. I guess it almost always is. And 2 minutes is a challenge.
But, no doubt.
You know, in the next 10 to 20 years, you know, electric vehicles and a billion more consumers hit the market. What is artificial intelligence? But let's in the near term, certainly the trade war escalation, what's going on there, a Middle East, escalation as far as saber rattling. But even more domestically is the domestic production remaining robust and providing a near source of oil and natural gas, which all these companies participate in, and increasing demand here and abroad is key. The other aspect, I'll touch on quickly, is at the end of the year, we had a lot of volatility in crude specifically as OPEC and Saudi Arabia brought about 2 million barrels of oil to market and the Iran sanctions did not go into place. I think both parties learned from that, and I would expect that going forward, they're going to remain a balancing force, they being OPEC and Saudi plus Russia, remaining a balancing force in the market.
Yeah, and of course, in the news right now, as you mentioned, there's a saber rattling with Iran, so it will be interesting to see what happens with oil prices there. Todd, we'll have to leave it there. Wish you all the best with these ETFs. Certainly an interesting approach. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you, Nate. I appreciate it.
That was Todd Sunderland, partner and head of quant strategies at Cushing. And you can learn more about their Sector Plus ETFs by visiting CushingETFs.com. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit LeggMason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Next week, Matt Bartolini, head of Spider America's Research, will go in-depth on smart beta ETFs. We'll discuss both the pros and cons here. And then Bob Toll, co-founder and president at Procure AM, will spotlight the recently launched Procure Space ETF, which has one of the best ticker symbols now, UFO. Until then, have a great week, everyone.